Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly write about how movies and popular culture relate to humans.
This is Still Processing. So we're back. This week, we're talking about the Super Bowl, but specifically what it means that Justin Timberlake is playing the halftime show.
Which means we also then have to ask how Janet Jackson is feeling.
And what have we done for her lately? Before we get to that, let's check in. Wesley, what's heating up your world?
Well, for one thing, you.
Oh. Oh, me, oh my. I did blush, I think.
You wrote a really great profile of RuPaul. It was really, really good. You know, you raised all these issues in this piece that ran in the New York Times Magazine last weekend, and you can find it now, listeners, and you should read it immediately if you haven't already. But you just raised all these really important questions about what drag has historically meant and what it means to perform drag in the 21st century. And, you know, he's a fascinating person. Drag is incredibly fascinating, and you made me think about it in a way that I hadn't previously ever interrogated. Aww. And I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks.
It's really good.
I feel like I have to update it to include like Reba McEntire as Colonel Sanders. Like, I don't know. I gotta figure that out.
Jenna.
Anyway, all right.
Why?
I guess not. Let's just move on.
Oh.
What else?
What else? Oh, I have to offer two corrections for the episode we did, our first episode of the season and the episode last week. First of all, Jenna, you might not know this. You didn't say anything when we were talking about it, but Annalise Keating has apparently been made to see a therapist.
Twitter told me so. Yeah, I got the receipts. Twitter told me.
I complained at the top of the show 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago that the craziest women on TV are not seeing a therapist, but a judge or somebody made Annalise Keating on How to Get Away with Murder see a therapist. So thank you, Jesus.
I have to say, too, I love our listeners because there's a mean way they could let us know about that, but they didn't.
They're always
just sent
nice.
The receipts and the great gift, yep. And it was just like, oh, thanks, guys. Noted.
I appreciate that. The other thing is that when we were talking about outrage and anger, I misidentified the university that facilitated Dr. Larry Nassar's abuses all those years. It was Michigan State University, but we also pointed out that all that anger was being put to good use and those people are leaving their jobs.
Yeah.
So that's great. And then the last thing, I watched the Grammys a couple nights ago.
Me too.
I don't have a lot of thoughts about it. I just wanted to notice some transitions. Jay-Z apparently turned into Lou Rawls.
He looks good.
Sam Smith is turning into Justin Timberlake.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on there. He's like somewhere between George Michael circa like 1993.
If he were printed poorly in a 3D printer, like a human version, like, ugh, no, but go on.
And Justin Timberlake circa like, I'm loving it, 2003 Justin.
That's mean. Okay, well, it is a shady week. We are invoking the spirit of Mama Ru, I guess so. Keep
and,
going.
And winner of the night, Bruno Mars, is apparently just full on coming out as Michael. He is just, he is all the way there.
The best thing about the Grammys for me, though, is there was like a whole thing going on about whether or not Bruno perms his hair or not. And it was clearly just people like riling up the Bruno supporters because he obviously has curly hair. Like, he obviously, since a small child, has had curly hair. But it was just people being like, stop hating on my short boyfriend. You know, it was great.
Listen, everybody knows I love Bruno Mars.
We love Bruno.
He's the Trojan horse of sexy. So what's going on with you?
Well, since we're on the topic of the Grammys, I have not been able to stop thinking about Rihanna in that Bordeaux latex number with the gloves, looking like she about to announce a Dexter reboot. Like, I was like,
I don't know what that was.
I already tweeted that joke. I'm sorry. But I'm just like, look, she's happy. She looks very well. I don't know what she's doing, but I don't want her to stop doing it. She's so curvy and she looks so healthy. I'm just very, obviously a little more than excited about it, but it just brings me a lot of joy. Like, I just feel like a well-fed body is like a sign of health and happiness and wealth. And it just brings me a lot of joy.
J'agree. What else?
Okay. So I had the pleasure this weekend of going to a Barbara Hammer exhibition at the Leslie Lohman Museum in Manhattan. And I don't know how I spent so much of my adult life not basking in the misty aura that is Barbara Hammer, who's an amazing American filmmaker, visual artist, queer artist. There was just something really, when I think of ephemera in 2018, I think about the tweets I've missed and the gifts I've missed and just all the moments I can't keep up with. But this is a person who is treating her life as ephemera. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is dedicated to her films, but then also letters, you know, letters she received from her lovers and also friends, hilarious feedback on her earlier films. And, you know, you could just tell there were like a lot of men like typing in these comments in her film class and saying things like, I didn't get it. Like, or are the women just gonna have sex the whole time? You know, it's just this like great cultural moment. And then she'd made all these satin jackets, very much in the style of the Grease Pink Ladies, that said hot flash, you know, talking about menopause and just things that we never talk about when it comes to women. There was a whole station set up about how to check your breasts for nodes and lumps. And I don't know. I hope that young artists are still keeping track of all the things they're making and experiencing and little snapshots and, you know, little postcards from their road trips that they can eventually put into some sort of retrospective like that. Because it just felt, it was more exciting to see the sum of her life than just look at the work she made throughout her life, if that makes sense. She's still living, but...
Can I say a horrible thing? I never look at those details in a show like that.
You must!
I know. I always skip them.
Oh my God,
I just look
hilarious.
At the work.
Oh God, it was so funny.
Yeah, I'm a weirdo. Gosh. I know.
Well, the last thing I want to talk to you about, just going to jump the gun, is that this week, Wesley, there is a major celestial event in motion.
What?
I really need you to prepare yourself. Gird your loins. We are in the midst of a ginormous supermoon. So it's a full moon and a blood moon and a blue moon and a supermoon.
Holy sh!
It's really exciting. The moon is our
friend.
Yeah, it's yay. Sorry. But you just have to be ready because the moon invokes a lot of deep emotional things. The moon is a dark light. It is a light that shines light on things in the dark. So you just have to be ready for a lot of shadowy underself things to come out. And the way you prepare is you just ride the wave. You don't make any major decisions. We're in it right now. Like it's happened. We're in it. The shadow of this crazy big celestial lunar event. And if you have access to any roses, I would definitely say buy some roses, smell some roses, douse yourself with rose water, which I've made in preparation, of course. If you have any crystals, carry them around to keep yourself soft and tender and, you know, malleable, because there's just a lot of things at work in the universe right now.
Soft and tender and malleable. My album dropping in 2 weeks.
I should also say this moon's in Leo, and Leo's a sign of drama and theater and excessiveness. So just...
That's a lot.
You know, it's a lot of energy.
Who should I be avoiding in all this?
Probably me, but I'm going to help you through it.
I was going to say, are you safe? Anyway, all right. So here's the deal. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl halftime show of 2004. We're going to talk about it because for reasons that are really probably none of my business, Justin Timberlake has agreed to do this year's halftime show, which is going to happen on Sunday. And I don't know how everybody else feels about this, but I definitely know that when I heard he was doing that, I was immediately...
traumatized.
I was re-traumatized.
We were re-triggered.
I could not believe... Well, mostly it just sort of confirmed for me everything that we already knew to be true about the way this country works.
So here's the thing, though. Okay, Justin's back, right? He's got a new tour, a new album, and this new shiny halftime show to promote it all. But when we look back 14 years or so ago, the thing is that that event was a turning point for both Janet Jackson and for Justin Timberlake.
Yep.
One person's career continued to ascend. The other person's career essentially flatlined.
Yes.
And we have to talk about why that is.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to talk about why America was so freaked out about this event. It actually has more to do with the theatrics of the Super Bowl and sort of ideas of propriety and like puritanical values that are
taste,
you know, taste.
Yeah,
and deeply
buried.
But, you know, after the incident, Justin said he took 10% of the blame, right? Even though they both were involved. And the person who suffered the most inarguably is Janet Jackson. And so this, the return of this event is just bringing up all these feelings for us and kind of gave us the impetus to really try to celebrate Janet and her contributions to culture, because there are so many, and because she's been basically buried since then, it's hard to remember what they are.
Yes. And I think it's just really useful to just sort of revisit this event, to also just like think about how the world works, or how this country works anyway, when it comes to these sorts of things. So we're going to talk about Justin and Janet and the Super Bowl and what it all means. But, you know, if it was, if he got 10% of the blame,
she's getting 90% of our show.
She's going to get 90% of this show.
Yeah.
So we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So let's just break down what happened.
Okay.
I mean, just like an actual
play-by-play. Yeah.
How we got to this point with the halftime show performance.
All right. So step one, we get to halftime.
Yes.
Janet comes out, kills it with All For You.
Yeah,
a couple other no-name people play. Just kidding. Other people perform.
Diddy and Nelly and
sure.
Jessica Simpson.
Whatever.
And Kid Rock.
Okay.
And then the whole thing ends. It culminates.
Finale.
With Janet Jackson mm-hmm. doing Rhythm Nation.
She comes out of the stage to do Rhythm Nation.
She comes back.
Head to toe in like gorgeous, you know, black, shiny leather, Alexander McQueen.
I have to say, this is a real model for the future of the halftime show. This
okay.
Just this Rhythm Nation performance.
Mm-hmm.
The choreography is tight.
Yes. Enormous stage dynamic, like huge acrobatic things, like all over, erected all over the stage.
She looks great. She holds the stage. The camera can follow her, and the choreography is great. And then up through the stage comes Justin Timberlake, a beatboxing.
Also dressed like a dollar store version of an Abercrombie model. Like, whoever put him in those cargo pants should get fined.
Old Navy.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, so the two of them do their thing. They're, you know, catting about the stage, dancing, flirting, grinding.
Doing Rock Your Body, his song. And, you know, basically what it looks like to me in a weird way is a more empowered version of The Way You Make Me Feel, the Michael Jackson video.
Yes.
Where,
oh my God.
If you recall in the,
yes.
in the Way You Make Me Feel video, Michael Jackson is basically street harassing
ugh.
Tatiana Tumbetson, the beautiful Tatiana.
Yes, yes,
and she's
yes.
trying to get away, but can't escape.
Pumping at her,
street.
Like,
yes.
give me your number, but put it in
thrusting
my pants.
Thrusting and gyrating,
yeah.
and she's
my penis
like,
wants
oh
your
my
phone
God,
number.
I cannot escape these guys.
But in this performance, it's an updated version of that, and it is Janet anointing Justin.
Right.
said, come on and dance with me.
I wanna rock your body.
Let me rock your body. Come on and dance with me.
And also, can we just say that, like, she carries the whole show for 90% of it, and then he comes out for, what, 90 seconds and does his little dumb thing and then manages to ruin her career?
Yes.
Jeez.
No disrespect, I don't mean no harm.
Talk to me, boy.
They're doing this dance on the stage, and then it ends, and he pulls off the breastplate.
The bustier, the black leather bustier. He rips off.
By the end of this song.
The stage goes dark, but then the world explodes pretty much over Nipplegate.
Yeah. So everybody freaks out. And there is something really interesting to me about looking at photos of that moment.
Yeah.
Where she's looking down at the breastplate in his hand. He's looking at her breast.
Like, but like with like the teeth bared.
Yeah. I mean,
he looks nervous, but there's like, it's not a comfortable sexual moment at all.
Well, no, I mean, we have to talk about this, too. These are two people who I would argue have complicated relationships to sex. I don't think Justin Timberlake's is actually that complicated. I also just don't think it's that sexual. And Janet Jackson is somebody who pretty much wound up devoting a lot of her artistry to these explorations of sexuality and its limits and its potential limitlessness. And to have these two people on a stage together under these circumstances was just really interesting and weird in the first place. But then to have this fiasco happen.
Right.
And immediately what happens in the after, it's quite clear in the days after this event that America is coming for her and he's just off doing something else somewhere.
Well, America needed a scapegoat. They needed someone to blame. There was all this freak out. The FCC said they had 500,000 complaints about the incident, although in hindsight, they've said, well, people were kind of mass organizing and calling. It's not like there were necessarily, you know, 500,000 American households outraged, but, but that was just the number of complaints that were lodged. The event is still one of the most TiVo'd videos in history, which might say more about where TiVo is at, because I don't know what that means about their market share.
Yeah.
But, you know, the point is that people, they paused it, they rewound it, they paused it, they rewound it. There is a common, you know, piece of lore in Silicon Valley that that's how YouTube got started, because one of the founders, who's the least visible one, which are, like, raises some alarm bells for me. But, you know, he said, I couldn't find this video. I wanted to watch it. And so then I started coding a video platform where you could easily find and search for videos. So and it was a cultural event that completely reshaped a lot of different American landscapes, namely how we talked about the heir apparent to the Jackson throne. I mean, that's the thing, really, that's like Janet Jackson is in some ways the answer to a question that was left unfinished with Michael. We never got to see what would happen with Michael. We never got to see if he would ever come to terms with himself or love himself more, or we would ever figure out what was going on with him. You know, like she kind of was supposed to be this beacon of that, you know, like the end of that or the second half of that legacy.
To have this happen and have it happen in such a strange fashion sets her up to be the answer to these other questions, though, too.
Right.
Right. I mean, what did she know? When and when did she know it?
Well, what do we know? It's been over 10 years. How much have either of them said publicly? Were they in it on together? Was it? I mean, let's put on our clue hats. Like, what do we know?
We don't know anything. We probably know as much now as we knew 14 years ago. Janet Jackson has said that it was an accident, and she didn't want it to happen. I mean, we should just play the Oprah clip.
So we're back with Miss Janet Jackson. We're on Oprah show tomorrow. It has been now almost 2 years since Janet's Super Bowl halftime performance made news around the world. First of all, I have to ask you this. Was it planned, Janet?
No.
It was not planned.
Well, what people don't understand is he was to take and rip the piece off that he did.
The leather piece.
Right. But more came off than what was supposed to.
Okay.
I have no reason not to believe that. You can see the orange lingerie underneath the black part of her outfit.
But it looks like it's stitched on. Like, it doesn't look... I've done some CSI level diagnostics of that image, which is just control and enhancing over and over again.
Of course
it doesn't look
did.
Like they're two pieces of fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, the nipple ring that's underneath is so ornate.
It would have looked weird underneath
the red thing.
The lingerie,
But who knows? Honestly.
I'd take her word for it.
I take her word for it.
Because again, to somebody's point, somebody being both Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake, who cares? I mean, in a weird way, I mean, it forensically, yeah, it's kind of important, I guess, to know, because we treated this like it was a gate. We had a name for it. We called it Nipplegate. And, you know, the government wanted access to every document the MTV production had. They wanted, like, to see all these emails and program notes.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of to explain, because I think this might, I mean, I'm sure there's another sort of big cultural fiasco that involved this convergence of the government, sports, and mass entertainment. But I can't think of one that operated on this level that got as many conservatives
riled up.
Yeah. And so it is crazy that all of this anger and outrage fell on this one woman.
And
who, in the moment, honest to God, just stood there and, like, had her boobie exposed.
For, like, what was it, 9/16ths of a second?
Yes.
It's, like, some ridiculously short amount. Well, I mean, that image is burned in my brain forever. Like, I remember it still very clearly. But why do you think so much came to rest on that? Like, what else was happening in American culture at that time?
It was the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that a lot of people were just, I don't want to be too much of a conspiracy theorist about this, but I do think that emotionally, psychically, it was so much easier to be upset about this than it was about invading that country.
Mm.
And it was such an easier place to sort of get on a high horse.
Well, I mean, easier is maybe one way to frame it, but it also might have been, if this big catastrophic thing is happening, America's going to war, then we have to preserve this idea of what America is and who we are. And what we are about is, I mean, I'm making this is hypothetical, but, like, morality and dignity and upholding, like, a certain level of standards. And, like, this is not it.
Right.
Like, we can go to war, but actually exposing your tits on national TV is not what America's about. Like, I think there's some of that in there, too, which was this indignation about how America was being viewed on a global scale, too. And so this just kind of added into that sort of, I don't know, criticism.
So let me just introduce something.
Okay.
I'm not bringing this up to get anybody off the hook, but I do think it's important to point one thing out, which is their age difference.
Mm-hmm.
She was much older than he was at the time.
True.
She was 38.
Mm-hmm.
He was 23.
Right.
And I don't know how much of a difference the age difference makes in some ways, but I do think that she was, like, a much older adult. Or she'd been an adult for a much longer time than he had been.
Yeah.
And I just think there are ways that she handled it better. I don't know if it was because she was forced to by the people who were managing her, or he had a better management team for being able to avoid all of the fallout.
That's giving him a lot of credit, but
I think that the culture around this incident is very important. But there are also just some circumstantial things that probably matter, too. I think he probably had people who were like, Justin, shut up. Don't say anything.
Mm-hmm,
don't go near anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Just this happened, whatever. She's going to take the heat.
Yeah.
And that's just going to have to be the way it is.
I also think, too, I don't know how either of them were supposed to recover. You know, I don't mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not Olivia Pope. Like, I don't know how to fix it. You know, and I think they both handled it as best they could and tried to let it just die down. It just didn't ever go away for her. But I want to point out something, though, so rewatching that moment now as a woman who's not that much younger than Janet was at the time when this happened, a couple things stood out to me. Number one, she's wearing, we keep talking about this bustier, this thing she's wearing, this breastplate. This is not just your average outfit. This is a custom piece designed by Alexander McQueen. It is meant to package her body. It's leather. The tearaway parts were included intentionally, I'm almost certain, because you don't build a piece like that to come apart. You know, there's a kilt, there's leather, there's fur. Like, she's signaling things about who's in control on that stage. Mm-hmm. She wants you to know it's her.
Mm-hmm.
This summer, I did a lot of research into the black BDSM movement for various personal reasons. Don't worry about it. and some of the things I've been reading, this incredible book called The Color of Kink, Black Women, BDSM, and Pornography by an academic named Ariane Crux. And in the book, she talks a lot about how the Black female body has a very complicated and ugly relationship to trauma, specifically sexual trauma from the time of slavery. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. rope play invokes a lot of those, a lot of the ways in which the body gets bound and tied up and gagged invokes a lot of that imagery. Mm-hmm. But for Black women who engage in this kind of play and engage in this kind of work, it can be a way to reclaim the sexuality of the body without associating with whiteness. Mm-hmm. It's a way of saying mm-hmm. this body isn't really a site for that trauma. I'm pushing, it can be more nuanced than that. But also it's really about like, you don't have to look at a trussed up Black body and think about slavery. There's a subjectivity and an agency and a power that I'm holding within that. Mm-hmm. And Janet's entire discography is about BDSM. I mean, mm-hmm. Velvet Rope, 1997, there's a song called Rope Burn. Uh-huh. The lyrics are literally tease. Tie me up, yep. You know? And then later on, she
tie
goes
me
on.
Up, tie me up. Let's listen yeah. to a little bit of that.
Okay. But, you know, this is years before Rihanna dabbles. Well, let me not shade my girl because I think she's into this stuff too. But, you know, it's like this is years before S&M comes out. But my point is just that I think we're kind of overlooking the optics of what it felt like to watch that moment. I think in the choreography, Janet looks stunned and shocked. This is part of the display, right? But it was actually like upsetting. Like there was a part of me that could have the fantasy that he did do it without her consent or that she was embarrassed. She wasn't embarrassed. She's got that gorgeous starburst nipple piece that's probably like thousands of dollars like underneath right. that outfit, yeah. you know? But yeah. but the mock, right? I'm assuming it's mock. Clutching and discomfort is really upsetting. And I don't like the way it feels to watch any man do that to a woman on a national stage. And we're also in this moment, you know, where we're talking about what men do to women when they have the upper hand, whatever that means. So I think there's all these ways in which that moment subconsciously triggered those 150 million Americans that the FCC said were watching and offended when this moment goes down. And they didn't know why, right? It's not really about, kids see more boobs than adults do, really. You know, it's not about the children. It's never about the children. And she's engaging in this very particular kind of play with this young, you know, milk-fed boy from Tennessee. Mm. America didn't want to see that.
So we've done the halftime show, broken it down. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about our complicated feelings about Justin Timberlake.
Yes. Okay.
Can we play that part of Senorita?
Oh, I like where this is going.
In the middle.
Now listen, I want to try something right now. See, they don't do this anymore. I'm going to sing something, and I want the guys to sing with me. They go, it feels like something's heating up. Can I leave with you? Right. And then the ladies go, I don't know what I'm thinking about. Really leaving with you.
I will say, the reason to introduce this is for me. When Justified came out 2 years before that, 2002, I guess. It's the first thing I had heard that Michael Jackson had not recorded that sounded like plausible Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That song, Senorita, was produced by the Neptunes, Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo. And it has like these essential Michael Jackson properties. It's
definitely
got a sense of humor. It's got great singing.
Flirty.
And it's got swagger. And seeing, you know, in my mind, this was a guy who I honestly believed had like a lot of the pleasure of Justin Timberlake was this like Michael Jackson flavoring that he had and was clearly cultivating.
Yeah. Well, if I can just jump in for a quick second, though, but what that really is, though, is taking all of the elements of Blackness that make music good and putting it into this avatar that's not threatening, I'm using quotation marks, but that isn't, it is much easier to digest, right? Like, there's a reason Nelly didn't get that song. You know, like, all these things are, there's a reason, right? Like, there's a reason why Nelly was like, we're taking off.
I got secrets, can't leave Cancun.
Yeah, so Justin was someone who was seen as sitting very close to what we think of as like some of the most influential musicians, Black musicians that in recent historical memory, but he never went over the line and he never made it too sexual. He was like he was like a neutered Ken doll,
yep.
You know, at the juke joint. That
See,
was his
you
appeal.
You are in my brain. You are
scary.
Finishing my train of thought.
Scary.
So I did not believe Justin Timberlake as a sexual being. I believed in him as a Michael Jackson hologram of some kind. Michael Jackson is still alive at this point, but it's just different. But this is a person who seems plausibly like Michael Jackson, but without any of that like funk and stank that Michael Jackson has.
Right.
The like the belief that, you know, Michael wasn't he wasn't sexual in a way that you he also wasn't sexual.
He wasn't.
But he understood he had like a nasty gospel. He could get all up the gristle and the fat of a like he could do all those things that are something else that are might even be better than sex in some ways when you're listening to music. Yeah. Justin doesn't have that. So there's like a little boy quality to him. So you put him on stage with this woman who was in clear sexual control and there is something boundary testing on his part that really made me uncomfortable. And he clearly was being set up to be some kind of future Jackson.
Right.
In some way.
Right.
And there was, it just, I was really upset by the image of this kid doing this thing to this woman in a way that just felt wrong.
I totally agree with that. And I would say, you know, I think he mostly got away with it until about 2016. Do you know what I'm about to bring up?
No.
In the aftermath of the BET Awards, when Jesse Williams, the actor on Grey's Anatomy, among other things, gets up on stage, wins an award, and then delivers this like incendiary speech that's like gift and memed and just like spreads around the internet.
We've been floating this country on credit for centuries, yo. And we're done watching and waiting while this invention called whiteness uses and abuses us, burying black people out of sight and out of mind while extracting our culture, our dollars, our entertainment like oil, black gold, ghettoizing and demeaning our creations, then stealing them, gentrifying our genius, and then trying us on like costumes before discarding our bodies like rinds of strange fruit. The thing is that just because we're magic doesn't mean we're not real.
So this happens, and then people just start going in on Justin Timberlake on Twitter. And he,
After the speech,
yes. Dumb Justin Timberlake weighs in and goes, at Jesse Williams, though, hashtag inspired.
He
hashtag
went at him?
Hashtag BET 2016. First of all, I the second hashtag, you set yourself up because you're getting, you threw yourself down the river, my friend.
Oh,
you lit
boy.
The raft on fire and then sailed down the river. Okay, so then after that, people went in. So one person writes to him, so does this mean you're going to stop appropriating our music and our culture and apologize to Janet too? Hashtag BET Awards. And then Vic Mensa goes on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore and basically directly talks about Justin Timberlake and says, we're not feeling him being down when it's beneficial to him and turning a blind eye when it can be dangerous, which lets you know Black Twitter never forgets. And I also think if Twitter had been around in 2004,
I don't think this would have happened.
But I think that we would have been able to shape the way it was perceived. And I think we would have
We would have been there for Janet.
And we could have said, like, actually, this is out of control. We could have wielded the outrage machine for good. We could have wielded our anger in defense of Janet. And they do listen. Like, they, meaning like Viacom, would have listened. You know, it could have shaped her career differently. This brings us right up to 2018 and what's happening this weekend with the Super Bowl, which is, you know, Justin Timberlake's new album is called Man in the Woods. It's out this weekend. And it's essentially him going back to his roots, going back to his country self. One of the first singles off the album is called Say Something with Chris Stapleton. Sometimes. I'm not gonna lie, it's kind of good. It speaks to my, you know, country self. But the lyrics, the main lyrics of the chorus are, sometimes the greatest way to say something is to say nothing at all. Like, what? Mm. I mean, yes, sir, proven, clearly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that is one way to live your life. That's for sure. And then to outsource the saying to somebody else. I mean, by all means.
Sure.
But I have such mixed feelings about the masks that Justin Timberlake can put on and take off. Mm-hmm. Because he sincerely seemed to want, when he was in NSYNC, when Justified came out, I think his pairing, his relationship with Timbaland, his producer, and then the Neptunes as producers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's very much collaborating with people who have an expertise in the sounds of blackness, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I've just been really fascinated by Justin Timberlake's relationship to his whiteness. And I hadn't really thought that much about it until he started doing those sketches on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Mm-hmm. I don't even think he's trolling us. I just think that he is a white man mm-hmm. who has a relationship to his whiteness that has nothing to do with Sexy Back
yeah.
or the Neptunes.
That's real.
And it's such an interesting celebration of a ludicrous version of whiteness. There's something that he has with Jimmy Fallon that's so different from what he has with like Pharrell.
Yeah.
And just seeing them, the two of them, do like the history of hip hop on The Tonight Show together. Mm. So they come out and like go through like 30 songs.
We like to party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. We're just a man that's on the mic. And when we rock up on the mic, we rock the mic.
Right? Fight the power.
Yes.
The power. Fight the power.
Let me hear you say.
Fight the power.
Yes.
We gotta fight the powers that be.
Jimmy, we've been through this before.
Yeah.
You are not straight out of Compton.
No.
You are straight out of upstate New York.
That's right, yeah. I guess.
It's obviously, like, not the most comfortable thing, but it also, to me, speaks very directly to the Justin Timberlake project, which is to try to make these two halves cohere.
Yeah.
And I think Man of the Woods is probably going to wind up being some sort of attempt to do that.
Yeah. No, I guess what I'm saying is it's interesting that this is the album that, you know, will lead him into the Super Bowl, because he's going to be playing again with this dichotomy. But it's not, in this case, it's not necessarily white and black. It's like white and white for Justin Timberlake.
Yeah.
White and gray. Because he's like, you know what I mean?
Well, let's see who he brings to the show.
Yeah.
We know who's not going to be there, though.
And on that note, we should take a break and then come back and celebrate the queen, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
I'm nasty.
I know you are.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Excuse me.
You know how we knew we were supposed to do this show?
Yeah.
We went and got coffee mm-hmm. on the way here. Mm-hmm. And what was playing but yeah. this song?
We stepped on the escalator and then we both tuned in to this song. And it was just like an omen from above. It was a really... You almost started crying, I have to
I
say.
Did.
It was beautiful.
I've seen the world in tonight and places. Runaway, which was on her greatest hits collection, not on an album. I just feel like one of the things that's interesting to me is the way in which we, not just the idea that we take Janet Jackson for granted, but that the Jacksons are like elemental to our understanding of ourselves in some, yeah. in so many ways.
Yeah.
And it just was nice to be in a public space and hear Janet Jackson.
It felt really
special.
It was
just great. She... to me, is the quintessential pop star. Unlike a lot of other people, like major people, she doesn't really have a gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that she was one of those people who, she tried to figure out what kind of pop star she was even going to be.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about this song is just how happy she sounds. She sounds so pleased with life.
Mm-hmm.
And... light and fun, and it's right before Velvet Rope. So she goes from this lightness to the darkness of that album.
Such a good song.
She started her career on TV. She was an actress on Good Times and then Different Strokes and Fame. And then she put out two records before she put out Control.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is really good. It's called Dream Street. It's got Come Give Your Love to Me. I love that song. But then Control comes out in 1986, and it makes her a superstar.
Give me a beat!
And she's working with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And they manufacture together this great sound that's like this really hard, driving, metallic, beat-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It really sounds like you're in a song factory. Like all of these pistons and gears and
I love
metal,
that.
Metal being pressed.
Sitting in the movie show, thinking nasty thoughts.
That's
so
the sound of Nasty to me.
I love
know?
It. Yeah.
You know, the way the drums work on that, where the drums are sort of going back and forth. And
okay.
She's like, no, my first name ain't baby.
No, my first name ain't baby. It's Janet. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
So one of the most famous bridges.
Oh, yeah.
In all of popular music.
So many Twitter bios aim like away messages like, thank you. We owe you so much, Janet, for just giving us so much cultural content.
I mean, what is it about her you think that is so meaningful? Like, I mean, like, what made her so good? I mean, part of it was this idea that she was somebody who became famous for declaring that she was going to be her own woman. She comes from this famous family.
Right.
Famous male-dominated family.
I was going to say, I think a popular reading of that declaration was that it came at the background of being from this famous family. But I think the more we get away from it, the more you realize she was just talking about herself as a woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. living in America and trying to be her own person. I think for me, you know, Janet was one of the first concerts I paid my own money to go see, had terrible seats. And it was everything. I went with my college roommate and childhood best friend, Nikki Woodhouse. And... you know, we had like nosebleed seats. I feel like the tickets were almost $100 and we were like agonizing over like these expensive tickets anyway. But it was amazing. And I was, as you were talking, I was just sitting here trying to think about what was it about her that attracted me to her so much. And I think that she always offered an alternative way of being. You know, when you're a young woman and you're a young girl, you're always looking at public facing women to try to figure out who to map yourself onto and who to sort of shape yourself in the, you know, in the mold of. And Janet was someone who shapeshifted. You know, she looked different all the time. Her face looked different all the time. She sounded different all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within that ambiguity, sometimes she offered a window into the possibility of a woman not being one, you know, static thing. And that always felt really, really powerful to me. And even that the Oprah interview that we keep referencing, she talks a lot about her relationship to her body. And she talks about, you know, her relationship to eating and her relationship to her body images and dysmorphia. And those are things that I suffer from. And I'd never had a language for that until I heard her and Oprah sitting on Oprah's couch talking about being an emotional eater. And I probably looked up the bag of Doritos I was inhaling after a bad day at school and was like, there's a term for that, you know? And I think, you know, she did offer, she was this beacon of light in a sea of a lot of white pop music culture. You know, it was Janet and then everyone that came after Janet.
I will say I have a lot of very important, vivid Janet Jackson memories, but one of them was, and you can talk about this as a woman, was the Pleasure Principle video. It was maybe the sixth song off of Control that she released as a single. And it's her in a warehouse in a t-shirt and jeans and the straightest hair you could ever hope to have, if you are into such a thing. And I can remember nobody around me understanding what a weave was or what a wig might be, and that Janet had just gotten her hair really straight.
Right.
And it really moves. And she did a lot of damage. A lot of damage with the hair. But she had a look for each song off that video.
Yeah,
she did. Each video from that album, from all the albums, were a world unto itself.
Yeah.
And I never knew what she was going to try. And each look was distinct. And the thing about Rhythm Nation, which came out after Control, was, I mean, she had always been kind of, demure was an aspect of what she was presenting in some way. Mm-hmm. Her sexuality was hers, and if she wanted to share it with you, that would be her choice.
Right, but it was always offset by that, like, super high-pitched, like, that super high-pitched feminine voice, too.
Yes.
That was, like, that was the foil to the, you know, everything else.
I think we should just take a moment to talk about how good she sounds.
Yes.
And how you don't really appreciate her as a vocalist because she's not about 10 other people. But she's a genius in the recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
Her albums have the best interludes. She's the best interludes. I mean, I don't like interludes, but if people do them, they should do them her way.
And to get a sense of what we mean, just watch the intro for What Have You Done For Me Lately. It's so good. Anyway, go on.
But I think she got more adventurous. I mean, we can talk about Scream in a second.
Mm-hmm.
I think she makes The Velvet Rope,
mm-hmm.
and then she makes All For You. I think
so good.
I think All For You might be my favorite Janet record. And it's got my favorite Janet vocal on it.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
You Ain't Right, which is the first song on the record.
Uh-huh.
And this is the opening song on this album.
Mm-hmm.
It just is, it's Janet sounding like she's dying. She's like got the flu,
uh-huh.
and she's laid up at home. And basically, as it turns out, if you can understand the lyrics, because she's singing at the lowest register I'd ever heard her sing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple songs in Velvet Rope where she does the same thing. She's singing about a girlfriend who basically broke her heart. The chorus comes, and you hear, ooh, ooh. And you're like, oh, she's okay. She's not that sick. Surprising because you don't see it coming. You don't know where this song is going to go. But underneath that, there's Janet talking. You can hear her talking during the chorus. Then you can hear her like ad-libbing something else, like,
mm-hmm.
this is for the clubs.
Right.
I mean, and it's all her. And then somewhere in this song, she's beatboxing, you know, toward the end in that mix of vocals. And
so what you're really saying, though, is that she's just completely multidimensional as an artist, as a vocal artist. Like, she's playing around with so many formats, so many different styles of performance, like,
yes,
within a single
yes,
song,
yes.
in a single moment, which
and
is something we take for granted, because
totally
everyone
it for
does
granted.
It now. But, you know, that was her signature move.
She had a soundscape and her voice was a major part of it.
Yes.
And she probably knew the limitations of what she couldn't do. You know, she knew she wasn't Whitney.
Sure. She wasn't Mariah. She knew. She wasn't trying to be, though. She was never trying to be.
But she also did things. I think her not being them freed her to do all this other stuff with her voice.
Which is basically play with it.
Yes.
I mean, yeah.
That's what we want to hear as listeners. Right. I don't want to hear the same thing every time, necessarily. But surprise me with what you think your voice can do.
She was an experimentalist.
I mean, and she did have like a just natural sexiness. I remember looking at her like in the When I Think of You video, just walking on that set. And she just has this like stutter step as she's walking in this on the soundstage. And she's got a bustier. Mm-hmm. And she's so full figured. And she just has... Mm-hmm. She's so into like how full her body is. I just love all of the ways that she looked over time.
I definitely came to that parade of looks and various selves retroactively, because a lot of this happened kind of before I was really cognizant of her in a sense. Mm-hmm. So I came across this trove of imagery and videos and albums. But I do remember so clearly how important it was when TRL or 106 in Park was going to debut a new Janet Jackson video. It's like you had to be home to watch that video so you could talk about it at school the next day, because you never knew what she was going to do. And if you didn't know, then you had to suffer through lunch, like, you know, like embarrassed. And then, you know, there wasn't really internet. So like, how are you going to find it? Maybe like the AOL homepage has it. I don't know. Like you had to be there, and they always made it worthwhile. I'm thinking specifically about the Scream video. With Janet Jackson and Michael Jackson in their weird tricked out spaceship, supposedly the most expensive video of all time, still one of the craziest, weirdest videos that preceded, you know, a lot of the high production Missy Elliott videos that then, you know, obviously again, continue to be iconic in their own ways. But they did it first. They always did it first.
I think we should just talk for 1 second, Jenna, about how black this song is.
Yes. Well, it's also, it's a song about resistance and refusal, i.e. like attention from the press, being packaged. I mean, the lyrics are things like, I've got to get stronger. I won't give up the fight. Keep changing the rules. You know, it's about them trying to survive, essentially.
I mean, and it totally predicts what winds up happening to her anyway.
It does. You know what I mean? It does. But it also sets a precedent, too, visually for what artists like TLC, Missy Elliott, even Aaliyah go on to do.
Yeah. And there were three things that were controversial when this video came out.
Mm-hmm.
Thing number one, Janet gives the middle finger.
Right.
Thing number two, the stop pressuring me and like the second go around to the chorus after the break. They say, stop f***ing with me.
Oh,
and they really say it.
Oh, wow.
And the third thing is that she's pig standing up.
Right, right.
And that was a mind-blowingly big deal in 1995.
Something else I always loved about this video as a kid, too, though, is that it does feel super politically black in a way, but they're also refusing ideas of what blackness is, right?
Yes.
They're looking at Jackson Pollock's. There is Andy Warhol imagery. There is Akira, like imagery from anime and Akira.
Japanese iconography in a lot of ways, too. Yep. So you have to leave the planet in order to become
free.
The black person you want to be, which is free enough to like float in space.
And play squash and hang out.
Yes. And it's some of the best singing she's ever done, I would say. Because she's trying to keep up with Michael. And, you know, Michael can just sound that way, you know, filling his water glass.
So ordering at McDonald's.
Right. I just feel like there's something about singing with him that makes her need to keep up with him.
Oh, yeah. And dancing,
really
too.
Dancing. Well, there's this great moment in that video where there's a breakdown where the guitars happen. There's a guitar solo in the record. And the two of them, I mean, it's just crazy choreography. And they're a tandem. She's not keeping up with him. They're keeping up with each other. In terms of the fallout after the scandal, after the Super Bowl scandal,
mm-hmm.
it was really fascinating for me to see where she turned after that scandal. To your point about Black Twitter and what it would have been able to do for that debacle as it was happening, it just reminded me that where she wound up going
mm-hmm.
after the Super Bowl halftime show and all the fallout was Tyler Perry,
mm-hmm.
which in a weird way at that time would have been like going home.
Yeah.
In a sense. It was the only place for a lot of Black people to get work
yeah.
in the movies for at least 5 or 6 years.
Right.
And she got to explore a side of herself that was simultaneously Janet and whoever this bougie person that Tyler Perry was asking her to play. But it was just, she was in a world that felt really safe to me and comforting. You know, she was around other Black actors, like
right.
really good Black actors.
Right.
And just seeing her in something like For Color Girls, which I don't even think works, but all the ways in which it don't work are really great.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the ways in which she tried to find some sort of spiritual solace.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine what going through something like that actually does to you. You know, in terms of your art, I mean, she didn't change too much. I mean, she made another record in 2006, 20YO, which I think is like the best of those of that late period Janet Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like I just can't imagine what having been through whatever she went through would have done to her.
But I will say, I think there's a part of her that has found that solace. We saw Janet on her most recent tour when it came to New York, State of the World. And I'd forgotten, too, how much she used her music as a political platform. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of songs that are about what's happening in the world, global poverty, income inequality. And that I was moved because I was like, what pop star opens their show with like a 90-second montage about war? Like, it was just like, she was just like really like, these are the issues that are important to me in this way I'm going to present them to you, which is just a thing that doesn't normally happen, I don't think.
Right.
But, you know, and I'm going to say this, and I don't know, it's going to sound unkind because I'm not sure I was expecting her not to have it, but there was such relief and pleasure and joy in watching her still have it, it being the moves, it being the sounds, it being the sexiness. At one point, she did a series of ballads in like an oversized denim coat. And it was just like, yes, mommy, like you look great. Like it was just all face and hair. And it was just like, she looked incredible. And I think I felt so deeply grateful in that moment. And you and I kept turning around and looking at all of Barclays, sold out pretty much, right? It was sold out. People's faces were just completely cracked open with delight. And I think what they were responding to, or at least what I was responding to, was her level of comfort on stage. And there was no hesitation, no uncertainty. She was completely at home in the songs that made her famous and the songs that she's still making now. And it was just a really beautiful thing to witness. That is not something you see in pop stars over 50.
Right. I also think that she was moved by how happy we all were to see her.
Undamaged. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes, it's like whatever. I think we were happy to see her whole.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
The way you don't get to see someone like Britney Spears on Vegas. She's not whole.
Yeah.
You know, no, Christina Aguilera and Madonna. They're all still chasing their former selves, and it's uncomfortable to watch. Janet is like, I'm here. I'm great.
But I've been thinking that the thing that's gotten us talking about Janet Jackson is this halftime show on Sunday. And how re-traumatized we are and how sympathetic we are on her behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know how I'm going to, I don't, like, watching it, I don't know how I'm going to feel. I mean, I'm definitely going to watch it as a person who is fascinated by Justin Timberlake.
Absolutely.
As a person who likes Justin Timberlake as an artist maybe half the time.
Yeah.
And They are, to me, conjoined. They are conjoined in my appreciation, mm-hmm. in my awareness that one got done a little dirtier, a lot dirtier than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a real dirtying. You know, it wasn't something that, like, we just made up.
But I think we can clip the psychic umbilical cord between the two of them. I actually don't know how tethered they are to each other. They obviously are. That's because that's why we're talking about
right.
them. But I just don't think her success hinges on his anymore. And I think what we've watched is a uncoupling of the last 10 years that was done very consciously on Janet's part. And then the rest just kind of happened over time. And I think it's good that our memory is long. I think internet's going to have a ball on Sunday. And I think it'll be really interesting to watch Justin Timberlake perform this other version of himself that's getting back to his roots on this national platform after the last time he appeared and was trying to masquerade as a white Michael Jackson. What happens to him after that is not up to us. But I think for me, I feel like I've watched someone redefine what success means to them in mm-hmm. this cultural landscape, which mm-hmm. is not about having what Justin has.
Right. Right.
It's about an entirely other separate set of things, which actually feels like the only logical conclusion for any woman in America. Now that I think about it, you know, it's like redefining what it means to have success on your own terms. That's our show.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, Josh Gwynn, Ann Hepperman, Henry Malofsky, Jessica Jupiter, and Max Linsky, all from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss. We have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
And our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from his album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
We appreciate it.
Bye.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.